And our second case this morning is Marca Donatos versus Woodridge, case number 12-2619. Mr. Shedden? I'm sorry if I mispronounced your client's name.
Oh, you got it fairly well. It's a long name. May it please the court. The village of Woodridge, when it arrests someone, takes a $30 booking fee from them, and the person never gets it back. It doesn't matter what happens after you're arrested. They can dismiss the charges. You don't get your money back. You can be acquitted. You don't get your money back. You can plead guilty, like Mr. Marco Donatos did, and you don't get your money back. It provides no process whatsoever for anyone to get this money back. Because it provides no process at all, under the Matthews v. Eldridge Supreme Court case, it constitutes a deprivation without due process. And the Supreme Court has held that the government can never deprive somebody of property without some system of review. There is no system of review here, and therefore there is a clear due process violation. To quote Matthews, what the court said was that some form of a hearing is required before an individual is finally deprived of her property interest. The fundamental requirement of due process is the opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. There's no opportunity to be heard.
Isn't this just really akin to a user fee for the jail?
The city says it's a user fee. That strikes me as rather Orwellian to say that it's a user fee to be arrested. There are cases dealing with charges for people who are incarcerated, and there they are getting services. They might be getting the services against their will, but it's not the same thing as being arrested. I mean, I think there's a clear difference between those two things. I mean, you're basically...
Is there any user fee that you know of that's been imposed without either criminal conviction or voluntary action on the part of the person who's charged?
Not in the criminal context, or not in where we have exercise of police power. I mean, there are user fees that people incur for using government services, but that's voluntary.
That's my point.
The difference with the arrest is it's not voluntary. And for that reason alone, we believe that the district court was wrong to dismiss this case. And there was some argument here that due process was accorded because the police know who they arrested, and therefore they're not going to take the money from somebody who wasn't arrested. Well, that seems to me to be a tautology.
Well, the problem with this analysis is that Matthews against Eldridge really isn't helpful here, okay? Because Matthews against Eldridge assumes that there is an issue to be decided, right, of fact or law or judgment, whether Mr. Eldridge was disabled. The way this ordinance is written, there is nothing to decide, right? And the problem, as I see it, is your client's claim was ripe the moment the money was taken from him. You could have brought suit then, even before anybody knew what the outcome of his charges would be, or even whether charges would be filed, right?
Well, I regret that, Your Honor.
The defendant has said, no, there's nothing to decide here. Everybody has to pay this fee. And there's no risk. We're not going to make any mistakes as to who's arrested. And that's probably right. But as we said in Johnson against Evanston, that's the point. That's the problem.
But we agree with that, Your Honor. We think this practice clearly runs afoul of the ruling in Johnson. With respect to we also had a substantive due process claim, and I understand that that's a high burden to meet, but substantive due process,
I would encourage you not to spend a lot of time on substantive due process.
Then I will not, Your Honor.
My colleagues may disagree with that, but I was concerned, though, Mr. Shedden, about one of the points in your complaint, or in your briefing, when we were going through the Matthews against Eldridge factors, which judges tend to do almost reflexively when due process is alleged. You said the private interest here is modest or minimal. And I guess I want to question that. we did a little checking, and it turns out that $30 is the average weekly food stamp allotment to feed a person for a week. That doesn't seem so modest.
Well, I would agree with you, Ron. We conceded that point because we believe even if it was considered to be a modest interest and you analyze this under Matthews, that it still states a cause of action. For many people, $30 could make a big difference in their lives, whether or not they could get shelter, whether they could get food. But unfortunately, and the reason that we agreed to concede, basically, for purposes of argument on the motion to dismiss that the interest was modest, is that there is a great deal of case law that seems not to care about small amounts of money. It's a different sort of case, but in the Idris case, there was 90.
The amount doesn't make much difference in terms. Well, if it's modest, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference in deciding then. Let me restate that. If it's a modest amount, then it may well be that post-deprivation procedures are sufficient to protect the individual interest. But we don't even get into that kind of analysis here because there are no post-deprivation procedures.
Correct. There are no procedures whatsoever, and therefore we believe under Johnson the practice is unconstitutional.
Is there a false arrest claim available under state law?
If you were falsely arrested, but they take this booking fee from people who are not falsely arrested. They take it from people who they arrest with probable cause and then later on decide, well, we were wrong. We were wrong that this person is guilty of the crime that they were charged with.
Well, right, but to
this would be part of the damages, you know, if you had a false arrest claim, but that's not going to include everybody, right?
Correct, and here what we're looking for is to get the $30 that was taken refunded.
Mr. Sheldon, let me follow up on one of Judge Hamilton's questions about whether this is modest or not. And that gets to the point of what happens if I were arrested under this ordinance and didn't happen to have $30 in my pocket? What happens as a practical matter?
Well, we don't know. What we believe happens, and we don't have a record on this because we didn't get to take discovery, is that they'll take whatever money you do have. If you have no money, there's no provision in the ordinance itself for the city to collect the money. A booking fee receipt was given to our client acknowledging that he paid the $30. In that receipt, it says that the amount is due within 15 days. And the village cites some portion of its code that authorizes its director of finance to collect debts that are owed to the city, but we don't know what happens with that. We suspect that it may just be ignored given the small amount of money relative to what the village budget is.
Does that make a difference here?
I don't think it makes any difference. The fact of the matter is they take the money from most people because most people have the $30. To the extent that they didn't take it from somebody, then that person doesn't have a claim.
So it doesn't show up as an unpaid fee of some sort that triggers further action on the part of the city?
We don't know. I don't know if they're reporting this to credit reporting agencies or not. I don't know whether, you know, we don't know. We just don't have a record on that because we didn't get to take any discovery. Well, we'll rely on the Johnson case. We believe this is a violation of due process and that it's unconstitutional. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lemley.
May it please the court. My name is Brandon Lemley. Pardon me. We believe there are two primary issues that need to be addressed on appeal today. And one of them has not been addressed at all. And that issue is standing.
Why did you leave that for the last issue in your brief?
Your Honor, this is one. Apologies. It's the type of hindsight's 2020, Your Honor.
Well, the plaintiff wants his $30 back. Why doesn't that give him standing?
Your Honor, the injury under Article 3 standing for a due process claim is not the payment of the fee. The injury for a due process claim is the inadequate procedure afforded.
Well, it can be both. If the inadequacy of procedures afforded causes you to have lost your $30 forever, then $30 gives you standing. A dollar would give you standing, right?
Your Honor, what you're talking about has to do with the merits of should plaintiff had had a procedure, would he have prevailed? But as the Tenth Circuit says, in addressing the standing on a procedural due process claim, that's not the inquiry. The inquiry is whether or not the underlying facts are in dispute. And here, the underlying facts are not in dispute, even if the plaintiff had been afforded the procedure that he seeks. Nothing would have been any different because he doesn't contend he was falsely arrested, and he doesn't contend
Even if he had been falsely arrested, though, he wouldn't have a remedy here, right?
But what you're
Because the ordinance imposes this deprivation on everybody who's arrested, and their claim is right the moment the money's taken, right?
What you're saying, and what the plaintiff, my brother, has argued, is that due process protects procedure for procedure's sake.
What this is about is whether the government can simply grab your money and because it wants to and provide no remedy for compensation. Because
Honor,
under this ordinance, there's nothing to decide except whether the plaintiff was arrested, right?
Right. The substantive provisions of the ordinance are clear. And when the substantive provisions are clear, the plaintiff can't rewrite the ordinance, which is what he's trying to do here.
No,
he's
actually,
trying to rewrite the ordinance.
You're trying to rewrite the ordinance by trying to use his guilty plea as a defense, right?
Your Honor,
you're arguing that the fact that he pled guilty to the shoplifting offense means that he doesn't have standing to bring this claim, right?
Your Honor, to the extent the plaintiff has argued, which is the only thing that is alleged in the complaint, that individuals who were acquitted of their crimes are not entitled to the refund of the money. That is what's alleged in the complaint. The plaintiff, obviously, was not acquitted. He pled guilty and was found guilty.
But that makes no difference under your ordinance, does it?
No, and Your Honor, the reality is that short of altering the fundamental provisions of the ordinance, short of this court rewriting the law, the substantive provisions don't allow for this type of rewriting. What the plaintiff is essentially arguing is a substantive due process provision, which is to say the ordinance should be substantively different. And on that respect, we believe the district court, Chief Judge Holderman, was correct when he said, no, because in fact you pled guilty and in fact you're not contending that due process, or pardon me, that.
Right. The problem with that analysis is that it rewrites the ordinance. I can imagine an ordinance that said, we're going to impose a $30 fee on everybody we arrest who is convicted on charges stemming from that arrest. And that would be perfectly constitutional. It would probably be constitutional. But that's not the ordinance you all have written.
Your Honor, this ordinance is, is actually a fairly common ordinance. And in fact, in 2011...
That's not a help.
In 2011, the state of Illinois enacted a provision of the Illinois Municipal Code, which is virtually identical to this provision. And I only bring it up. Woodridge is a home rule unit, which means it can enact ordinances that aren't allowed by the Illinois Municipal Code. But in fact, now there's a provision of the Municipal Code that allows for similar ordinances to be enacted by all municipalities. There is a difference.
So we need to worry about this being widespread.
We do. And there is a difference. That ordinance provides for $20, not $30. But be that as it may.
Well, let's focus on this. For purposes of the procedural due process claim, what is the risk of error that more process would remedy? Because I think you're right when you point out that the remedy for a procedural due process claim is more process, not a different substantive ordinance or your money back. So what is the risk of error that more process in this instance would remedy?
Your Honor, we don't believe that there's any risk of error that would be, number one, under the substantive terms of the ordinance, and Judge Hamilton, I respect your opinion with regard to that, but under the substantive terms of the ordinance, there is no risk of error. And Judge Holderman theorized about this hypothetical situation in which perhaps a non-arrestee is charged the $30 fee. In that case, the risk of error is so remote, and Matthews versus Eldridge holds that due process concerns the generality of cases, not sort of the extreme fringes. The risk of error of a non-arrestee being charged the $30 is so remote that the type of informal notice or informal process that Judge Holderman theorized is absolutely adequate. Additionally, because the decision to charge the booking fee is a separate decision from the decision, the underlying decision to arrest made by a different officer, the adequate tort remedy of false arrest provides the opportunity to receive not only the $30, but many more damages indeed.
What is the filing fee for a civil claim in DuPage County?
Your Honor, that I do not know.
I believe it's $115 for a modest claim. I believe we've said only madmen would file such claims for $30.
Well, Your Honor, if you do prevail in a false arrest claim, you're entitled to not only your damages, but you're also entitled to the costs of suit. And the lawsuit could, in fact, be filed in district court. Of course, that is a higher filing fee.
Do you really want us to suggest, are you really trying to suggest to us that post-deprivation remedies are relevant or sufficient here?
Judge, we believe that they are. In fact, because the two decisions that are at issue are different. For example, a plaintiff cites a case out of the Ninth Circuit, Stittman. Mm-hmm. They cite it extensively. And there, the case dealt with the procedures in determining the underlying offense. The underlying offense was a parking violation, and it dealt with the towing of a vehicle. And it dealt with how quickly a hearing was held on the underlying offense, the offense itself. Our case doesn't deal with a situation in which a fee is imposed for the offense. Rather, it's a separate, it is related, but it is not a fine that is charged because you are arrested. Rather, it's a fee that's charged. It's designed to recoup the costs of booking, of the costs involved in processing the individual, which includes fingerprinting.
What's the remedy for someone who is arrested with probable cause based on mistaken identity?
Your Honor, if their arrest was based on probable cause, there is no remedy.
Thank you.
The point is, if the officers had probable cause to arrest, then it was proper to charge the booking fee. And here, there's no dispute about whether or not it was proper, or whether or not there was probable cause
example,
to arrest.
For example, if there's an arrest warrant erroneously issued by a court in the name of Brandon Lemley, and you get stopped by police in Woodridge, you're taken in. It's a different Brandon Lemley, but they don't know that. You pay your $30, you have no remedy, right?
Your Honor, in that situation, it was absolutely proper to arrest.
Sure.
It was absolutely proper to arrest. It's absolutely proper to provide the services that were rendered by the municipality.
Providing services to you? Is that how we ought to think about this?
Your Honor, absolutely. There are services associated with booking, with processing individuals.
How much would you be willing to pay for the pleasure of going through that process?
Your Honor, for what it's worth, I have paid for the pleasure of having my fingerprints taken when I became an attorney to pass the bar. It's the similar situation here. Individuals are paying for the fingerprinting, for the photographing, for the cost of being housed. And the fact that they were arrested.
You think it's comparable to get the to pay what you need to do to have the privilege of becoming an attorney.
Your Honor,
you're going through the experience of booking for a municipal jail.
Obviously, they're different situations,
thank you,
Your Honor. At the end of the day, the risk of error involved in this case is minimal because the ordinance is a standard.
Mr. Lemley, let me just. You're saying it's standard. So presumably courts around the country have upheld similar ordinances and fees, right?
Your Honor, within
have,
the...
Have any been upheld that did not include some mechanism for reimbursement for people who were cleared?
Your Honor, the cases in which there are cases, if I may answer, there are cases in which courts have questioned the constitutionality in that situation. But in each of those cases, there was an underlying law or an ordinance. For example, Naperville changed its ordinance when the plaintiff's attorney sued them.
Mm-hmm.
That allowed for the reimbursement of those fees.
Right. There's no such provision here. Is there any case in the country that upholds such a fee without a provision for reimbursement for people who are cleared?
Your Honor, there's not that I'm
thank
aware
you
of. And the reason is that there's no case where there's no provision that requires the reimbursement of those fees.
In other words, that's a substantive challenge to the
statute.
That's
a substantive challenge to the law itself. And in this situation, the law is substantively clear. There's only one substantive criterion. It is an absolute either-or binary decision. Either you were arrested or you weren't arrested.
Right, and if that statutory scheme passes substantive constitutional muster, then the additional process wouldn't serve any purpose because the risk of error.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Basic threshold determination of whether the person is actually under arrest or not is so low.
I'm not sure I fully follow the question, but I may have
skipped a step in the analysis.
Based on what I think you're saying, and that's sort of
it's important to separate a challenge to the substance of the statute and a challenge to the lack of process.
I agree.
And if there's a substantive flaw as a constitutional matter in a statutory scheme that says everybody gets charged this fee whether they were arrested in error or not, based on the sheer fact of their arrest, that's substantively unconstitutional, then there's a claim here, or at least if it's plausibly substantive.
And there is a substantive due process claim that's been raised, and in fact, to the extent the plaintiff is wanting to change the substance of the ordinance, that would fall under the substantive due process clause. But the problem the plaintiff runs into, and the problem identified by Chief Judge Holderman, is that to the extent he's wanting to change the substantive terms of the ordinance, he lacks the standing to do so, both because what he wants to change substantively is he wants to change the opportunity to be reimbursed the fee if he's acquitted, which he wasn't, and he wants the opportunity to challenge whether or not there was probable cause, which he doesn't contend. So because of that, the substantive due process allegation at issue here is not at issue because the plaintiff lacks standing to raise it.
Would the constitutional issues here be any different if the fee were $100?
Your Honor, possibly, but I don't know.
What if it were $1,000?
I think it would probably be different.
Why?
You know, there you're dealing with a interest to the individual that is substantially higher than a minimal $30.
But there's still nothing to decide, right?
Your Honor, ultimately, there would still be nothing to decide.
So your position would be the same if it were $1,000?
I don't
your
think
constitutional analysis is the same, even if it's $1,000.
Your Honor, I don't believe it would be. And I hate to say
you
safe by
answer
bell.
The question. You're not saying
I don't believe that it would be. I do believe that it would be a different constitutional analysis because the risk, the interest to the individual would be so much substantially higher.
But there would still be nothing to decide, right?
Under the terms of the ordinance, I suppose that's possible.
So the risk of error would remain zero.
Your Honor, there would still be zero risk of error.
Thank you.
For these reasons and those stated in our brief, we request that you affirm the decision.
All right. Mr. Shedden, you have a lot of time left.
There are no post-deprivation remedies available to someone who is injured by this ordinance. Pardon?
Who's injured?
Well, anyone who has their money taken from them.
So, everybody.
Correct, because the money is, the law is facially unconstitutional, we say, because it provides no process. And you have to provide some process, might be a very small process.
For what purpose? For determining the wrongfulness of the arrest?
That would be among them.
Okay, that's a substantive challenge to the statute.
Well, then what we
have, you're saying that it has to include an exemption for people who were wrongly arrested.
Well, then what we have here is the government exercising power without reasonable justification.
That's a substantive,
yes, it
rational
is.
Basis challenge.
Yes, it is.
And a $30 fee for everybody booked into the jail survives rational basis review. A $1,000 fee might not, but $30 does. I think you probably...
Well, I don't know that. Why does the amount of money make a difference? There's nothing in the Constitution that contains a de minimis exception.
Rational means for the jail to recoup the cost of booking.
The booking has nothing to do with the jail. Later on, when you're in jail, they have a whole another set of fees that they charge you, and those they can justify.
That's for the privilege of admission, I think we're talking about booking.
Somewhat akin to the privilege of being admitted to the bar, is what opposing counsel says.
I didn't mean to resurrect that hypothetical.
There may be some merit to that argument. Again, we believe that the Matthews case and the Johnson case indicate that this is a clear constitutional violation, and we'd urge you to reverse the district court.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.